and respond to future delicate safety concerns based on seeing national media coverage of Portland as a lawless and unsafe city. Because being perceived as an unsafe city is not an easy narrative to reverse, and because the physical safety of our visitors and hospitality employees is of utmost concern, we support the mayor's desire to set time, place, and manner regulations, as has been done successfully in other destinations. Most of us in the room have likely traveled to other destinations, seeking escape, new experience, and exposure to a place's people, culture, and local offerings. Imagine now getting a message from the hotel you are staying at communicating to you that the building is on indefinite lockdown due to protests in the surrounding area that are unpredictable in route and scope. You, along with staff, cannot leave or return to the property, and a level of fear naturally sets in. This is happening at downtown hotels, and this creates a scenario where several hundred guests take this negative experience from Portland back to share with friends and colleagues. This is one of the numerous ways the positivity that should come from a visit to Portland is being severely compromised. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Portland visitors, the local business community impacted by visitor spending, and our network of business partners in Portland.
Thank you. Commissioner Daly.
I have a comment, maybe a question. Thank you for coming here today, and I certainly appreciate your testimony and understand some of your concerns, but I want to make it clear that thousands of our community members who live in Portland live in fear because of the uprising of bigotry and hatred and racism being brought upon our city. So while I'm certainly sympathetic to tourists, they're not my primary concern. And the real threat are right-wing extremists coming to our city and intimidating, threatening, and committing violence against our residents. And I hate to think what that threat would look like if no one was standing up to them. So I just want to put it out there that, I mean, we have these rights for a reason. It's because free speech and assembly and protest are essential to our democracy. So I certainly want to work with you to address these concerns, but just wanted to give you a different perspective.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Our last panel is Kimberly McCullough from the ACLU of Oregon, Beth Wooten from the National Lawyers Guild, and in making her first appearance in this chamber as Commissioner-elect, Joanne Hardesty. Welcome and thank you for being here.
Mayor Wheeler and council members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I do want to let you know that I have fairly extensive comments, which I'm going to try to get through quickly. I have submitted written testimony to the clerk, so she can distribute that to you all.
Thank you.
I'm also happy to answer questions. I know a lot of this is complex constitutional law, and I also have Matt DeSantos, our legal director, here in case we need to pitch hit on some of those questions. Before addressing the ordinance, I want to acknowledge that we share concerns about the safety of our communities and the desire to make Portland an inclusive and equitable city. And we don't want to downplay the challenges that we're facing or suggest that we sit idly by when violence occurs in our streets. At the same time, we have deep concerns about this ordinance being presented as a solution to the challenges we face. And because we have such deep concerns, we urge you to change course and not adopt it. We believe it will lead us down a path of rights violations and costly litigation. As to our specific concerns, we have constitutional concerns and concerns as a matter of policy. At the outset, we are hard-pressed to see how this will actually prevent violence from occurring or reduce the use of law enforcement resources and police enforcement. Despite the suggestion that the imposition of these rules will reduce violence, we fail to see how that's actually going to be accomplished and instead have numerous questions. For example, if a person is willing to violate our criminal laws against assault, are they really going to follow these rules about when and where and with how many people they can protest. If someone comes to our city with an intent of causing harm and they do follow the rules, is it going to stop them from engaging in violence or problematic behavior at or near the free speech zone or in other parts of our city? It's also hard to understand how the ordinance that gives government additional authority to enforce new rules is somehow going to lead to reduced enforcement. It really is just creating another avenue for enforcement. And the fact that violence has occurred at permitted events with associated time, place, and manner regulations begs the question of whether these new rules will actually stop violence from occurring. We understand that the city attorney's office believes the ordinance is constitutional, but we respectfully disagree. The problem is we can't just say that reasonable, content-neutral, time, place, and manner regulations are constitutional and end our analysis there. With these kinds of regulations, the devil is in the details, and those details are incredibly problematic here. There are cases cited in the ordinance. We've also been provided with an additional list of case law that supposedly provides justification for this ordinance, but we have read all of those cases. They are all legally distinguishable with extremely different facts, and none of them deals with an ordinance like what we're looking at here. And the ACLU of Oregon is not alone in pointing to those constitutional concerns. I'm sure you've seen the recent media where there were three separate constitutional law professors at reputable institutions that all raised serious concerns with the ordinance. And I think it's important to note that none of us have had time, sufficient time to analyze this under Article 1, Section 8 and 26 of our state constitution, which provides even a more protection for free speech and assembly. As to some of those constitutional concerns, it suffers from overbreadth and vagueness. It also gives too much power and discretion to city officials, centralizing the power to dictate conditions on the exercise of our free speech rights in a single official. I think as a matter of policy, when we're thinking about this, we need to think not only about our present circumstances, but the future. We should ask ourselves how this power can be used and whether we can trust everyone who will use it. To use that discretion appropriately. We also need to think about other locations that may copy this ordinance and whether or not that copying that ordinance would lead to bad results in a different place. In addition, imposing legal consequences based on a city official's judgment that a group has engaged in a history of violence or has a likelihood of committing violence is extremely problematic. As an initial matter, it's unconstitutional to retaliate against protesters for past protest activity, and there is a heavy presumption against the validity of prior restraint on speech. In addition, in our society, we're entitled to due process and a presumption of innocence, both of which are absent here. Checks on official discretion are extremely important to prevent overreach and dubious findings of violence based on bias against particular groups. That's exactly why this ordinance risks being found to not be content neutral. All of this also raises questions about how judgments about groups of protesters will be made. Is there going to be a list? Is the list going to be public? How do you challenge those findings? How do you get off the list? It reminds me a lot of our gang enforcement lists. On a related note, this also creates a dangerous problem that it will lead to a heckler's veto, which is unconstitutional. Creating a heckler's veto means that if one group decides that they're going to go cause problems at somebody else's protest, that they're somehow, then they're able to impact that other group's protest rights. And again, that is not a content-neutral limitation on protest. In addition, the fact that the ordinance is aimed at specific groups of people is problematic because government should not be in the business of punishing groups of people for the past or present actions of a few people. We have deep concerns about how police will know who is and isn't part of these groups, and we certainly hope we don't have to remind everyone that we do have laws against tracking people's political affiliations. All of this raises even more concerns about how groups will be regulated as a practical matter. So when there is a protest, who is and isn't in the group, Does every single protest have to go to all the protest zones? I think Commissioner Udaly was getting at this a little bit earlier. So what if you have a completely unrelated protest on the same day? What if it's related to the same subject matter, but it's on the same day? Are you then supposed to go to these free speech zones? It becomes extremely problematic, I think, to try to figure out how that actually plays out. There are also limits on the number of people who can go to a protest, and I am really confused about how that would work. We also have deep concerns about the potential for criminal sanctions. I appreciate that the ordinance that is now before us doesn't have the 6 months in jail, but we still have questions because it says that there are potentially associated criminal penalties, but it doesn't say what they are, which is deeply concerning, and that potential for criminal charges could have a chilling effect on people's exercise of their rights. So this long list of concerns, I think, should be a strong indication that this will lead to costly litigation. There are a lot of things our community needs our time and resources for. Instead of diverting those resources into legal battles, we should be working together to create tangible changes that will truly help protect our communities. I have a long list of things the city could do instead of passing this ordinance, but I'm going to reserve that and say that I do appreciate the opportunity to engage in these conversations with you all. Happy to continue to engage in these conversations and try to find some better solutions. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mayor.
Commissioner Fish.
Kimberly, do we have a copy of that?
I sent it to the clerk just
maybe
10 minutes ago or so. I was proofreading, sorry.
So I'm going to ask if the mayor's staff could track it down, because there's additional stuff you weren't able to get to. And plus, I have a number of questions I wanted to ask you, but what I'm going to do is wait till all three panelists have concluded their testimony. Then I'll ask the mayor if I can have a few minutes to ask you some questions.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Very good.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners. My name is Beth Wooten for the record, but I'm here representing the Portland National Lawyers Guild. I'm going to try to keep it to 3 minutes, but I may go a little over since I'm representing an organization. So I'm speaking on behalf of the Portland chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Legal workers, lawyers, law students, and jailhouse lawyers engaged in the cause of collective liberation. One of our many projects is protester support for anti-oppression movements. That includes legal observing, the famous green hats, as well as jail support. We understand the desire to stop right-wing violence brought to our city by Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys. However, we view this ordinance as exactly what Patriot Prayer wants, an opportunity to enlarge the police state that has repeatedly attacked counter-demonstrators of their rallies. This ordinance does three things, and the changes to the criteria, I don't believe, change our analysis or concerns. One, it allows the city to arbitrarily place individuals into ill-defined groups. It polices the language of protest to craft what will undoubtedly be overreaching protest restriction. And it enables post hoc justifications for police violence against protesters. Generally, it is true that time, place, manner restrictions are valid exercises of state power per the First Amendment. However, when police are left to enforce these restrictions, counter-demonstrators get hurt. We and so many others have observed this. PPB chooses to send us all they've got. They line up, predominantly facing the counter-demonstrators, and separate the factions. Sometimes with no provocation, the police violently disperse the counter-demonstrators. Most recently, on August 4th, counter-demonstrators nearly got killed by police weapons and tactics. We refute many of the factual conclusions made by the ordinance describing these protests. No one but police deploy flashbang grenades, full-strength pepper spray, pepper ball projectiles, and other impact weapons that amount to use of deadly force. The ordinance activates when two or more groups have announced plans to demonstrate separately but on the same day, and there is a history of violence between the groups. How will PPB determine who or what a group is? Does someone who likes or comments or is interested in a Facebook event then become a part of the group? These counter-demonstrators aren't organized by traditional notions of groups. People show up and they go to protest because they're passionate about an idea and they want to stand up for it. They don't care who organized the event. They want to challenge the Kavanaugh hearing or stand up to Patriot Prayer. But given the vagueness of an ordinance, If a person wants to exercise their right to demonstrate, would that right be curtailed simply by a Proud Boy on Facebook saying he also wants to show up? This is precisely what Joey Gibson wants. Patriot Prayer wants the city to scramble any and every time he makes a peep on social media. The Portland Police Bureau has shown time after time that they do not focus on individual actors, but instead broadly cast demonstrators as lawbreakers to justify use of force. This ordinance will exacerbate that pattern by creating another layer of restrictions that many demonstrators may not even likely be aware of or understand. How do these written orders get dispersed? Once the written orders are broken, then will PPB have the opportunity to kick our butts, or kick the butts of counter-demonstrators, as Chief Outlaw put it in her Lars Larson interview. It's of note that the ordinance cites the Minotti decision to justify its validity. That case came after police actions at the WTO protests in Seattle, reviewing a city ordinance that blocked protest activities where world leaders were gathering. While the Ninth Circuit upheld the ordinance following a facial constitutional challenge, that was not the whole story of the case. The court found that the individual, as applied challenges to the ordinance's enforcement, could proceed to trial. That case was ultimately settled. Seattle's then Chief of Police, Norm Stamper, has since recanted the decision to clear protesters with tear gas. As here, this ordinance will just invite further violent police suppression of speech, as well as encourage lengthy, costly litigation. These are important considerations, since the ordinance will allow the city to limit the number of protesters at a demonstration. You might think it's incumbent on counter-demonstrators to just not show up. But that's irresponsible and ignorant of the history of fascist movements, which thrive on public normalization of their activities. This testimony is a broad outline. The Guild will be writing and submitting to your offices a legal memorandum detailing our concerns. We urge this council to reject this ordinance and understand that the community has been shocked and injured by the actions of the Portland Police Bureau at these protests. Rather than provide legal cover to state-sanctioned violence, we need to consider proactive alternatives to the threat of right-wing violence. But thank you for your time. Thank you.
Mr. Walsh, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor, afternoon. Commissioners. For the record, I am Joanne Hardesty, Commissioner-elect. I want to thank you, Mayor, and City Council members for the opportunity to speak on this ordinance. I am a child of the Civil Rights Movement. As a child of the Civil Rights Movement, I am very aware of the need to counter racist, stereotypical mantras that are meant to incite people to violence. I have been extremely disappointed in watching how Portland Police Bureau has responded to out-of-town hate groups who show up and take over our downtown streets. I believe after the August 4th protests, we were told that both you, Mayor Wheeler, and Chief Outlaw were going to independently investigate why nurses were injured, why reporters were injured, why regular people who I would hope all of us would want to stand up to hate groups, why they were injured by our police. What we know from video coverage is the police don't always tell the truth. There was no video showing counter-protesters attacking police. In fact, ultimately, the reason given was that they had to get back to their cars, and they had blocked themselves in. In 2017, before the Max stabbings, the gentleman responsible for that marched down 82nd Avenue with a police escort, a Portland Police Bureau escort. They were also escorted out of my community so that they could safely leave. When you look at the pictures of what is taking place in this community, the police have been a tool in the past, certainly from my childhood, of brutalizing people standing up for their civil rights. As I see this rise of white nationalists in this city, for the first time in my life, I am fearful when a pickup truck with an American flag rolls up near me, I look for the nearest exit. What is my exit strategy? We are a city known for protests. We even survived the George Bush years. We are known for making space for people to protest what they want to protest. It is our right as Americans. It is our obligation to stand up against hate. Because if the brave children and men and women had not stood up in the 60s, when people that looked like me were just trying to register to vote, trying to get decent housing, trying to get decent education, if we had not stood up, just because that was the law at the time, it was not a just law. I want to encourage you to slow down this ordinance, and let's have some community meetings in January when I join you, so that we can talk to the community about how we keep everybody safe. It's important for you to understand that we don't all experience the police the same way. When white women protest, the police come out with cameras and pussy hats and smiles. When African Americans and other people of color and people with less power protest, they come out in full riot gear. We cannot have a police force for white people and then a police force for everybody else.
Yes.
I would hope that we would take all the testimony today and slow this way, way, way down. I want you to know I trust Chief Outlaw. I believe that she has built a good team, but she is absolutely mistaken to think that we should give the police chief power to decide who protests, when, where, and how. And so thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I look forward to working with you to make sure all of us can feel safe when encountering Portland police officers, because that is not today, but I hope it is in the real near future. Thank you.
Welcome, and thank you. Our colleagues, any questions for this panel? Commissioner Fish.
Thank you very much, Mayor. First, I want to just acknowledge that prior to this hearing, a number of organizations reached out to my office, and I had a chance to either speak with them directly or through my senior staff, Georgetown Law Center, Brennan Institute, Urban League, Oregon Justice Resource Center, Western State Center, CARE Oregon, ACLU, to name some. And so I don't want to repeat those conversations. They've been helpful. I do want to ask Kimberly McCulloch a number of questions. And if the mayor would give me 2 or 3 minutes.
Absolutely.
And if it is, Kimberly, if it's your preference to follow up in writing with any of these questions, I urge you to do so because we got a little time. We're not voting today. And so I want to make sure I get the full benefit of your views. Now, I was not involved in either the research or the preparation of this ordinance. So when I hear my friends at the ACLU say that you're scrambling to do an analysis, take a look at both the federal questions and the state law questions, you're not alone. And all of us would like to get that right. I'd like to make sure we're looking at the right law and we're following the right guidelines. And obviously one of the questions that could come before the council is, can this ordinance be strengthened? We'll hear from others that there's no way that this can be strengthened. It just needs to be withdrawn. But, I mean, there's a range of views we've heard. So in the spirit of making sure I understand your views, and I have not had the benefit of reading your testimony in detail, which I will, again, after the hearing, here's a few questions I wanted to ask you. The case that the city attorney's office has relied most heavily on is called Menotti versus City of Seattle. And you can Google it and download it. And it's long, but I really encourage people to read it because whether you agree with the case or not and whether you agree with the ordinance or not, it's the roadmap that the city attorney's office used to craft this ordinance. So we have the benefit of standards set forth by a court. And I just want to make clear, do you and the ACLU believe Menotti is still good law?
There is a question about whether or not Menotti is still good law based on more recent precedent, but I think that's sort of less important than the fact that the facts that gave rise to that case were just absolutely and completely different than this circumstance. So if I could just describe that really quickly. There, the underlying ordinance was an emergency ordinance that authorized the declaration of emergency. We actually have that same ordinance here already in the city of Portland. And that what happened was there was a declaration of emergency that imposed a curfew on the city of Seattle. I was actually there when that happened and lived right next to the curfew zone was actually forced out of downtown. So anyhow, it was imposed in response to actions that were actually taking place. My colleague actually explained what ended up happening with that, but I think it's important to note that the city of Seattle ended up paying millions of dollars in settlements because of that action. In addition, I think it's also important to note that it was really not anything any of us would call good policing. They used tear gas on tens of thousands of peaceful protesters because a few people smashed some windows. In addition, when I heard that this was based on a Seattle ordinance, I actually reached out to our colleagues in Seattle and said, "What the heck is this?" And they were baffled, frankly. And then they came back to me and they said, "Well, it's interesting that this is being raised because recently the city of Seattle tried to impose some insurance rules on protesters based on past violence and a prediction that they would engage in violence." And the ACLU of Washington contacted them and explained why a number of different cases, including particularly Forsyth is sort of the ruling case there, that it is unconstitutional for them to do that. And the city of Seattle has actually suspended those rules and is considering rescinding them entirely. So they're actually moving
those rules about about requiring insurance.
Based on past violence and a prediction of violence. That's correct.
So I would welcome...
Excuse me just one second. Could I just interrupt for one second? Could you please turn the lights off on the back? Because I can't look at the speakers with the light shining right in my eyes. I get migraines. You're certainly welcome to film it. Thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry. I had the same feeling, Commissioner Fritz. Thank you for
listening.
So did
I.
If in your supplemental materials... So thank you. And if in your follow-up materials there were additional cases you want us to look at, welcome that. One of the themes of this hearing and materials that I've received are sort of a debate about whether the existing tools that are at the disposal of the police commissioner and the police chief are adequate, and whether there are additional tools that are constitutional that could help us meet what I think is a shared goal, which is to minimize violence and make the opportunity for peaceful protest as robust as possible. Does your testimony outline any additional tools that you're encouraging us to consider?
Yes, it does. In particular, we've heard this idea that if there are credible threats of violence, that somehow law enforcement is supposed to just sort of stand back and not do anything. If there are actual credible threats of violence, we think that law enforcement should follow up and should investigate and should try to prevent folks who are actually creating a clear intent that they're going to engage in violence to do so. We definitely encourage separating of groups that are engaged in conflict at a protest, and we've actually seen Portland police do that well in some instances. And in fact, the example that was brought up of the protesters being across the street from each other, aside from the fact that law enforcement was facing all one direction, which sent a very odd message, we actually thought that protest was going well at that point. Of course, then the kettling happened after that, which was problematic. But that's aside from that point. We do also think that, you know, when people commit acts of violence, that there are ways to hold them accountable. And those accountability mechanisms actually can prevent future violence. For example, in the civil context, restraining orders can restrict a person's movement. If a person is convicted of an assault crime or some other violent crime, they can be subjected to probation conditions. We obviously have concerns about over-criminalization of our communities, but when people actually engage in acts of violence, I think we expect there to be some response. In addition, we are a little bit confused about why there are some pretty well-documented instances where people have engaged in violence in our city that have not been appropriately dealt with. I'm a little bit perplexed about that. And I think this all raises another question, and I think my colleagues actually like raised this as well, which is that there has been many instances throughout the history of our city of the safety of our communities actually being endangered by police response to protest. And so if we're serious about addressing the safety of our communities, we need to talk about things like the use of crowd control weapons, what sort of de-escalation techniques we're using, and what kind of training law enforcement have to actually respond to protests in a peaceful manner.
Thank you. Let me hold you there for a sec. I'll read your testimony and I'll follow up. Mayor, if I could just have a couple more questions.
Sure.
This is enormously helpful for me. We did a little survey, and some of the groups we met with helped us on this, and we looked at places like New York, Denver, St. Paul, and others that had versions of a tool that the mayor is seeking. Some look very suspiciously very similar to the tool of the mayor. Have you had a chance to canvass other cities and to determine whether in the implementation of those ordinances or rules that are at least first cousins of what the mayor is proposing, whether they have been determined to raise constitutional issues?
So the closest things I've seen are things that are actually similar to laws that we already have on the books around permitting and the regulations that can be imposed on permits. I have yet to see an ordinance that looks like this. If someone can give me an example of one of those, I would love to be able to reach out to our affiliate in whatever other location and get their analysis. But I've seen a list of supposedly similar ordinances, and they're quite distinct. In my legal opinion.
So let me follow up. What you just said about permitting is very important because, as it turns out, and New York City's been in the news recently, they actually take a hard line if you don't get a permit. And they will take arrests of groups that don't get a permit. And historically, Portland has not done that. We have avoided taking mass arrests of people that don't get a permit. And there are a number of groups in the last couple years that have said, really as a statement of principle, they're not going to get a permit. So we have to make a decision. Does the ACLU have a view about whether our current hands-off practice about allowing people to protest without a permit needs revisions?
I'd like to pass on giving you a firm answer on that, and I think that's something that I would like to discuss with other folks and get back to you. But I will say that I did reach out to sort of our national listserv of affiliates and asked folks, you know, are there other jurisdictions that are doing this well? Because I would love to be able to point the city to some good examples. And folks at our New York affiliate actually wrote me back this morning and said there are good and bad things happening here and that they'd be happy to talk. So I think that we can engage in some of these conversations about what's working other places. I would love to be able to give you, to point you to a place that's doing this well.
Last question, and I appreciate your patience and thoughtfulness. Let's say under one scenario here, based on all the testimony we get and the input, the mayor proposes some additional changes to narrow the scope of this ordinance and to address constitutional concerns, but it's still, you still have concerns, National Lawyer Guild still has concerns, other groups still have concerns. What that could set up is a fight. Either once an order is issued and the city attorney said that a written order, someone could go to court and seek an injunction, or probably more likely when someone's arrested and the arrest is challenged under the order. This will get to federal court very quickly. We'll go to state court, then go to federal court. And in federal court, there'll be a debate about the constitutionality. So a federal judge will look at it, and a federal judge may say, I like this, but I have concerns about this. If out of that process came a stronger ordinance, what's the downside of that checks and balance? Since the system allows for judicial review, no matter what the council ultimately does, what's the ultimate downside in having a federal judge have the final say, particularly if it results in a strengthening of the ordinance?
the financial cost of litigation that lasts for years and years and years and years. When you have groups like ours who are willing to engage with the city, who are trying to work with you to figure out what a good ordinance looks like or what better policy looks like, because I don't actually think that this ordinance can be fixed. When we've got groups like us who are willing to work with you, I think it's better for us all to be partners. We don't need to be, you know, like head to head. I think we can be working together collaboratively to try to figure out something that that doesn't end us up in court fighting each other there.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mayor.
Commissioner Daly.
I do have some questions, but I would need the chief and the city attorney to come back to the
Certainly.
Table.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Welcome, Joanne.
Thank you. So there's often pressure to rush through these hearings. I think this conversation is too important to rush through, and this is an opportunity to put a lot of concerns on the record and to bring questions and concerns from the community. I am concerned with leaving enough time for public testimony. So I'd like to ask my colleagues who can stay past 5 o'clock.
I can stay till 5:30. I've had a long planned Water Bureau meeting that I have to get to.
It looks like we have a quorum at least till 5:30, and I think possibly beyond.
Can go along.
So I have been crossing out questions and trying to prioritize throughout this whole proceeding because many of my questions have been answered. And just for the sake of time, if you don't know, just say you don't know and you'll get back to me. If it's a yes or no, feel free to give me a yes or no. I won't think you're being curt, but here we go. In 1970, the Portland Police Bureau committed to not using violence on nonviolent protesters after a particularly violent crackdown on peaceful anti-Vietnam War protesters in the South Park blocks. I would like to know how many settlements we've had to make with protesters since then related to excessive use of force by police during demonstrations and what the estimated cost of these suits were. Probably you're going to have to get back to me.
Robert Taylor, correct.
Yeah. How many pending lawsuits are there against the city from protesters or advocacy organizations for demonstrations between November 2016 and now? What is the estimated cost to the city to defend PPP in these lawsuits?
Robert Taylor, since October 2016, approximately 13 lawsuits have been filed. You have in-house lawyers in the city attorney's office, so there's no additional cost to defend those.
But it is costly, and it's time that they could be spending on other work, if I'm not mistaken.
That's
okay. In response to this proposed ordinance, Daryl Turner, police union president, recently decried the overemphasis on de-escalation and disengagement. Is this view on de-escalation consistent with that of PPB leadership, Chief?
Danielle Outlaw, Chief of Police. No, it is not.
Thank you. How should we reconcile PPB's stated commitment to de-escalation with the numerous injuries we've witnessed on our streets, of which the most serious appear to be at the hands of the police? These injuries include third-degree chemical burns, open wounds, and at least one traumatic brain injury.
Is that for me or for you?
Go ahead.
Is that for me?
That's for the city attorney.
Okay. Robert Taylor, I would be happy to answer that. The one of the goals of the ordinance is to try to manage these events in advance so the police do not have to manage them the day of. And I think that's where August 4th is a good example of things that did not go well for anybody.
Okay. The next three questions are about dispersal orders, which I have found myself caught up in both before and after taking my seat on City Council. What are the, and I'm going to read them together and you can respond. What are the conditions that have to be in place for PPB to demand a dispersal order? dispersal orders are often contradictory, difficult to understand, or given without enough time for people to respond. What is PPB doing to remedy this? And why do the police believe that after giving dispersal orders, people who remain are fair game to be subjected to violence, even though they are not committing any violent act by remaining?
Ryan Lee, Assistant Chief of Police. The conditions to have PPB demand a dispersal order are outlined in Oregon Revised Statute 131.675. It's dispersal of unlawful or riotous assemblages. Essentially, when any five or more persons, whether armed or not, are unlawfully or riotously assembled in a city, in our particular case, the police can issue an order, a command to disperse. Failure to disperse is an illegal activity. Could you repeat your second part of that question?
What is PV? I mean, okay, so I understand we have the law, but it's incredibly difficult to get hundreds, if not thousands, of people to disperse in a timely manner or to effectively communicate the instructions to them. Also have an issue with the fact that hundreds or thousands of people can be involved in a peaceful protest, and five bad actors could cause the entire protest to require to disperse, and the failure to do so makes everyone engaged in criminal activity. That just doesn't seem reasonable or workable.
Commissioner, I'm stating to you what the standard for the law is. The police bureau holds themselves to a higher standard and an abundance of caution when dealing with the public. In regards specifically to how, and again, my apologies, Ryan Lee, Assistant Chief of Police, for the record, the police bureau's acquired specific equipment to make sure that our instructions are more easily understood from a greater distance away for those involved in protest. We also have the incident commander for any of these events approve whatever those dispersal orders are going to be. They review them ahead of time. The incident commander issues the order for those dispersal orders to commence. They're in an incident command post separate from the event where they've got a clock. It's a more sterile environment. They try to afford as much time as possible, as reasonable. And then to ensure that the instructions are consistent, whenever it's feasible, the technology we've actually bought allows for their instruction to be recorded, so it's the exact same instruction that's going out over and over again.
Okay. I appreciate the explanation for what is happening, but what is happening is not working, and it's not safe for people who are engaging in legal, nonviolent protests. So I'm going to cut off this question and just say I would like to hear back from the Bureau any ideas or strategies you have for improving on that process.
Commissioner, we'd be happy to have that conversation.
Thank you. From videos I've seen, it appears that counter demonstrators, and I'm talking about counter demonstrators against far-right extremists, are always the ones who are asked to disperse. Is this true?
I'm sorry, Commissioner. Can you repeat that?
Sorry about that.
To the best of my knowledge, counter demonstrators against far right extremist groups are always the ones asked to disperse, not the far right extremist groups who are provoking the counter demonstrations.
Deputy Chief Robert Day, Portland Police Bureau, and there have been many of these events, Commissioner, and B could not agree or disagree with that statement because it is definitive to say always, and I can't speak to every event that's occurred and every moment of police actions occurred in that time, but we can go back and look and provide you more information on that observation. If you have a time frame you want us to look at or a specific event you want us to look at.
And I apologize, I don't have the dates, but I think in the most recent or one of the most recent counter protests that resulted in police violence, I would like to know if you can provide video or other evidence that counter demonstrators threw projectiles at police before the police began using violence in any of those recent demonstrations. And obviously that's one you're going to have to get back to me on.
Yes, we'll follow up on that, Commissioner. Robert Day, Deputy Chief.
Next question. is about crowd control techniques. How is it legal to subject everyone in a crowd to chemicals, flashbang grenades, and other dangerous weapons when there is no individualized reasonable suspicion that they are committing crimes, much less violent crimes? Maybe that's the city attorney.
Robert Taylor, City Attorney's Office. The police have said that they're going to review the use of those ordinances in response to the August 4th demonstration. I think that's a good legal question that we'd be happy to get back to you on.
Thank you. The next series of questions is about perceived PPB bias. Portlanders have sustained countless injuries at the hands of Portland Police Bureau, but I can't recall any instances of protesters from Patriot Prayer, Proud Boy, or other right-wing extremist groups being seriously injured by police. Is this accurate? If so, how do you explain this unequal application of force?
Robert Day, Deputy Chief, Portland Police Bureau. At this time, I can't speak to who has or has not been injured. So it will once again require some follow-up on our part to look at who's come forward, express that, and take a look.
How would you explain the perception which has been reported in the media that PPB see Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys and other right-wing extremist groups as more mainstream than Portlanders who engage in counter-protests?
Robert Day, Portland Police Deputy Chief. That's an assumption that I can't speak for the people either making the assumption or gaining the perception, I should say, and I can't certainly speak on behalf of every member of the organization in that regard.
Last summer, Portland activists were kettled and forced to provide ID. I still don't understand why this happened. Can you help us understand why it happened, and has PPB ever recorded identification information from the Patriot Prayer or Proud Boy or other right-wing extremist groups in this manner?
Robert Taylor, City Attorney's Office. That event is currently the subject of litigation.
Okay. The issue of the police turning their backs to the right-wing extremist groups and lining up facing protesters was raised earlier today. And the perception in the public is that the police is actually defending the right-wing protesters. So I'm not asking for an explanation right now, but I'm asking if you can come up with a better strategy so Portlanders who are coming out to protest hate don't feel that our own police bureau is lining up against them.
Robert Taylor, City Attorney's Office. That's certainly a concern that has been addressed by others or raised by others. And part of the goal of this ordinance is to announce rules in advance so that folks can go to areas where they can demonstrate safely so we can avoid that situation like August 4th where one group announces they're coming, another group comes to counter-demonstrate, and then the police are lined up in the middle of the road to keep the groups apart. That is not a good situation for anybody involved. And this ordinance would give the police commissioner the ability to designate areas where people can go safely so we don't have that problem you've identified.
So I know that our policies have to be content neutral, but I don't have to be content neutral. And I'm just going to say that right-wing extremists pose a greater threat to our security and to our city than ISIS, let alone left-wing counter-protesters. Homeland Security, not an organization I expect to be in agreement with very often, wanted to include alt-right extremism in their domestic terrorism initiatives, but Republicans shut it down because they called it an attack on conservatism, and it was watered down so local police don't track or ID members of these groups in the same way. Can the Portland Police Bureau explicitly and unequivocally state that Patriot Prayer, Proud Boys, and similar right-wing extremist organizations are the real threat to our public safety?
You're in a position of Chief Outlaw, Portland Police Bureau. I've stated this before because I've been asked, I've even been asked to pick a side. You're in a position as an elected official to do that. Given that I am not in the Portland Police Bureau, we are not a political body. We are not in a position to do that. We focus on behaviors.
Okay. During the August 4th protest, my understanding was there were weapons checkpoints because of the threat of gun violence. Yet media reports indicate that the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer were able to breeze by these checkpoints. Can you explain why that happened, why no one was arrested, and how this ordinance would change our ability to regulate who brings what types of weapons to protests in our city?
Robert Day, Deputy Chief, and I apologize, Commissioner, that's still being reviewed by the Independent Police Review, so I can't speak to the specifics of August 4th. And I did want to affirm what I heard Mr. Taylor share and a better understanding of your question regarding the perception piece. We are having conversations and understanding with our members to make sure that when we're on the line and when we are present, that we avoid that perception. So I want to recognize that that has been heard, not just here, but in other venues, and we are addressing that piece. I failed to do so originally.
I'd like to give one of you an opportunity to explain the cache of weapons event and explain why that was not a crime and why no arrests were made in that situation. I'm not suggesting they should have been, but because there has been so much confusion in the public and inside this building about that event, I would really love to have it clarified on record.
Brian Lee, Assistant Chief of Police. For clarity, I was not present at that event, but I've reviewed the reports for it. My understanding of that event is that during, immediately prior to the event, as groups were starting to show up, we were literally having a briefing in the Justice Center when people observed large groups on top of the parking structure, which is at First and Jefferson. You can see the top deck from there. We contacted several groups there. One of the groups that was there were individuals that had with them three rifles as well as some body armor. Obviously, it's a venue that's raised. That did cause us some concern. We contacted them. They had the weapons stored in a manner that was lawful. They also had a concealed handgun license, which would allow them to have it. There was, as alarming as that conduct, and I understand why that would be alarming to the public, it wasn't unlawful, and we weren't in a position to make an arrest.
That's alarming, but I understand. So I gave myself a time limit. The time limit is up. I actually have two more pages of questions. I will send them to you, and I will want to publish the responses because these are questions from constituents and advocacy organizations, but I want to make sure and leave plenty of time for public commentary or testimony. So I do have one more question. We have a gang enforcement task force. Why aren't these right-wing extremist groups being treated as gangs?
Well, investigations, as the chief commented, are based upon behaviors, and so I can tell you that we're looking at behaviors of all groups, whether it be regardless of their association, we're looking for criminal behavior for investigations.
Well,
excuse me, Robert Day, Deputy Chief.
I don't want to be too confrontational, and I want to make it clear that I like and respect the chief, and I know we have a lot of decent, upstanding officers in our bureau, but I have some grave concerns with the bureau as a body and how they're exercising the power they already have, and that is why I cannot support this ordinance. My friend's son riding in his car with three of his friends, all young African-Americans, home on spring break from college, were pulled over for suspect behavior. And I agree with Joanne. When I see a truck flying American flags, I mean, it's a sad day when our own flag feels like a threat in our city. I feel threatened. I feel unsafe. I don't feel threatened by a car full of black teenagers driving through my neighborhood. So I just want to point out that I see an unequal application of our laws. And I fail to understand how the behavior of these right-wing extremist groups is somehow less threatening than black teenagers who aren't doing anything wrong.
Is that a question?
Commissioner Saltz.
Since you're going to be providing lots of information to us, could you also quantify how much police overtime has been paid since 2016 related to demonstration events, and how many times precincts have been had resources diverted, some of what Representative Biden was talking about, below, I don't know if it's been up to staffing levels, but below some level. So if you could get that information to us, I think that would be useful for us to have at our
So I provided, fingertips. Chief Outlaw, Portland Police Bureau, I provided a number since 2016 previously.
Oh, you did?
But okay. I will report back out to give you the specifics. I have a spreadsheet with details that I'll report back on.
And does that include diversion of resources from other precincts?
That
East
does
Portland?
Not. So we'll have to research that information for you to get to get you those specific details.
Okay. And then, Ms. McCulloch, I stepped out of the room for a second to grab a coffee, but I thought when I heard you coming back, you and Commissioner Fish were talking about perhaps constructive input from the ACLU and how to produce an ordinance that could pass muster with you, or did I mishear that?
Commissioner Saltzman, this is Kimberly McCullough, for folks on the record. We do not think that this ordinance could be remedied by amendment, but we are happy to engage with the city on suggestions about alternatives to the ordinance, and certainly are engaging in research and outreach to other jurisdictions to try to figure out if there are some alternatives that we could get other folks to suggest as well.
And by alternatives, you mean possible that could list of alternatives could include an ordinance, or is it still?
I don't know that it requires an ordinance, or if it requires just a change in practices, or if it requires something more creative. I think that this is something that we need to continue to engage in collaborative conversations with our communities about. But as to this specific ordinance, there are some really difficult constitutional hurdles to get over when you are basing restrictions on past activities and on predictions about future activities. That piece of it, and the fact that that's the core of the ordinance, is just not something that we think you can overcome.
Okay. I guess I'm just trying to get at, in all honesty, whether we can get past sort of the two schools of thought here. As one is, you know, we need something different to respond to what I think are situations that are ultimately going to result in Portlanders being killed, maimed, permanently paralyzed, are we going to sort of, and the other school of thought is, which is, we already have the tools, it's just the question of using the tools right. So I'm just trying to figure if we can bridge that gap, or do we just sort of need to, those of us up here have to choose which avenue we believe is going to be the most productive in keeping Portlanders protected.
Commissioner Saltzman, I appreciate what you're getting at, and my hope is that through engaging in conversation, we can actually reach consensus on what the best path forward is. I don't think it needs to be like I said earlier, I don't think this needs to be a situation where folks essentially coming into our city and causing difficulties cause us to be head-to-head. I think Portland is a very special place. We have a really amazing community, and I think we can work together to find solutions.
Thank you.
Mayor?
Commissioner Fish.
I know we're about to say thank you to this panel and move on to public testimony. First, we're going to take some amendments, then public testimony. I'm knocked out Friday and Monday with treatment. We've asked for some follow-up stuff. Commissioner Udaly has posed a number of questions. There's been other questions posed. I've asked some questions of the ACLU. We're obviously operating under, at least currently, a compact time frame. Who knows whether that will change. It would be helpful, though, to get some answers, say, Monday, Tuesday. I think this is coming back, at least preliminarily, is scheduled for Wednesday afternoon. Whether that holds or not is a council decision. But just in terms of timeline, I would love to see some initial responses on Tuesday of materials that you want us to review. And if, look, if we need more time, we're going to take more time. We're going to do this right. So thank you.
Thank you all.
Mayor, I have
Commissioner Daly, sorry.
You're fine to leave. I just have a...
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you all.
...small request. We have representatives from the Urban League here who've been engaged with our office, and I believe others on this issue. Could we invite them to speak before we open public testimony?
Well, let's do this. Let's get to the amendments.
Okay.
And then let's get to public testimony.
Let's do public testimony.
I'm sorry?
No, I think we should go straight to public testimony after the amendments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are they signed up, Commissioner?
They're signed up. There's just one individual.
Very good. So we have a number of amendments on...
So Mayor, can I walk you through my proposed
amendments?
Yeah, please,
why don't you do that? Fish,
so,
one, two, and
so
three.
So I want to be clear.
I'm sorry.
In the limited time I've had to review this matter,